From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. That gap between what happens in the brain and what comes out as behavior is the field of clinical neuropsychology. And while its application ranges from the treatment of military personnel to underinsured people in the Cape Fear region, the practice can encompass diagnosing and treating multiple sclerosis and dementia. New research shows there are at least 53 different ways to injure the brain in a battle zone, including the previously unexamined impacts of the blasts from improvised explosive devices. Here to help us understand the implications of this new research and the trends in the field of neuropsychology is Antonio Puente. He's a professor of psychology at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. He's also a clinical neuropsychologist with a bilingual practice in Wilmington that serves people who are poor and underinsured. He's founded and for 10 years edited the quarterly scientific journal Neuropsychology Review, and he's past president of the American Psychological Association. Professor Puente, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you for having me.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation during this live Wednesday discussion. If you have a question for Professor Puente, you can call us at 910-343-1138. You can also send an email to coastline at whqr.org. Professor Puente, if we define neuropsychology as that gap between what happens in the brain and what comes out as behavior, then what is not neuropsychology?
Well, I'm not sure there's anything else but neuropsychology. Behavior, cognition, emotion all starts with the brain and ends with the brain. The question is, how do we understand it? How do we modulate it? And maybe, how do we predict it?
And for so many years, this field has been focused on pathology, on injuries to the brain. And you've undertaken some research that has revealed new ways that brains get injured in war zones. Can you tell us about that?
Certainly. We started several years ago. In fact, it actually began with my work with the Carolina Hurricanes, diagnosing their concussions. And then we were receiving patients, because we're a TRICARE provider, of individuals that had come back from the war. And they reminded me of what was happening with the hurricanes, but not entirely the same way. So we reached out to Bethesda to get some guidance, and we formulated a battery of tests that was administered by myself and some of my students that ended up working at the Naval Hospital. We administered to over a thousand veterans that had returned, and we began to understand that the pattern that we were noticing just didn't match a traditional brain injury and didn't match a typical concussion either. And after gathering over a million data points, we now began the process of both cleaning the data and, more importantly, understanding how is it that you could get injured on the theater. And how is it that you can understand it? And finally, what do you do about it?
How do you diagnose, for instance, a concussion? Is that talking to someone, looking in their eyes, or are you actually trying to look at the brain?
Well, that's an interesting challenge. In fact, there's a new company that's coming out of a partnership with the private sector through UNCW, SportsGate, that's addressing that particular issue. But that's a very complicated way of just simply saying, oh, you can just diagnose it. First of all, it's a change in brain function that results in, hopefully, a short-term change in behavior. Concussions, blurred vision, headaches, impaired thinking, hopefully goes away. You do it by careful analysis of the behavior, sometimes by asking very simple questions, and sometimes by observing the behavior over a long-term fashion, especially in a structured scientific way.
So one of the things we know now about professional athletes who engage in these seriously impactive sports like hockey or football is they can develop CTE, or chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which Isn't that just repeated concussions or repeated impacts to the brain? And how is that different from what happens on the battlefield?
Well, what happens on the battlefield very often is a one time, or in some cases, a few times. In the case, for example, of hockey players, which we studied, when we first did the original baseline, we asked these people that were in their 20s playing professionally, when did you get the first concussion? They said, well, I don't recall. I think it was about 6 or 7 years of age. So we have a history of concussions. Then the challenge becomes, if you have that many concussions, are you likely to develop, for example, early onset of dementia? And even though it's not a point-to-point correspondence, we now know that repeated injuries to the brain, whether it's on the football field, on the basketball court, on the soccer field, can have long-term sequelae that may have impact that is subtle, difficult to understand, and highly impactful in a person's life.
You now have grown children, but knowing all this, would you have let your kids play hockey or football or any of these other super impactive sports?
Well, I certainly was very concerned knowing this from the very start. And it turns out they all played soccer, and some of them appear to have experienced concussions. I was very, very concerned, especially with the issues of heading or collisions that are unavoidable on the field. So we switched eventually to tennis. and for fun, surfing.
Oh, wow. And this is a good place to do it. So going back to the battlefield then, one of the things that you discovered is people can actually get brain injuries from the explosive blast of an IED, even if they're not actually hit with something. Can you explain how that works?
The way we have considered what we call traditional TBI, traumatic brain injury, has been some kind of impact. The head goes to the windshield, a bullet goes into the brain, or something of that nature. What we discovered is that you can get significant brain injury by what we have simple blasts that could travel through the air for fairly long distances, up to 100 yards, producing these effects that turn out to be permanent. Now imagine if this occurs inside of a tank. That's even more so because the sound waves reverberate like a super ball inside of a racquetball court. It becomes more intense. We started trying to figure out how many ways can you become traumatized, at least the brain be traumatized, and we discovered there's, like you said earlier, 53 different ways that a person has been injured in this very large data set we were able to obtain over a 10-year period.
So you're saying sound waves injure the brain on the battlefield.
That is correct.
That just the reverberation of sound waves inside a tank. And wouldn't you think that inside the tank you're a little bit safer?
The opposite. In terms of IEDs, the reverberations in the tank can actually be more exacerbating than in the open field.
When someone is returning from a war zone, how do you begin to distinguish whether they are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, as so many veterans are, or an actual physical brain injury? And is there a difference?
You're asking a very challenging question, and that is, can you get a physical impairment from an emotional trauma? And it turns out that in our data set, we have difficulty in some instances determining the difference between brain functioning and a person that has actually been injured by a blast and a person has been injured by PTSD. PTSD can alter the brain, and in some cases, in a very significant fashion, that produces behaviors that look almost indistinguishable from a blast injury, at least in our neuropsych measures. In a small portion of our sample, it looks like we can't tell the difference between the two. And in another sample, it looks like some people with PTSD appear to have brain functioning. They're actually worse than soldiers that have experienced the blast itself. We think of PTSD as an emotional injury. We're trying to reconceptualize as PTSD as a physical injury. Now, I haven't shared with you, but we've been actually working with people in refugee camps in other countries. And it looks kids like they've been set up in refugee camps for an extended period, like 10, 20 years. It looks like their brains are quite different than kids from the same country that are in a war zone but are not living in refugee camps as well.
How are the brains different?
Well, it looks like they're traumatized. It looks very much like they've been, quote, blasted.
What does a brain that's been traumatized look like?
Problems with attention, problems with problem solving, what we call executive function. Learning becomes a little bit of a challenge. Memory is problematic. And then you have a host of emotional symptoms, which we kind of expected, but not the neurocognitive ones, which we thought were fairly immune and could only occur only if there was a physical assault to the brain. So some of this data suggests that an emotional assault could have long-term and possibly irreversible effects on the brain itself.
So emotional causes can create physical impacts on the brain. Is that what you're saying?
That's what the data appear to suggest. Historically, we haven't thought of that because we think of organic and functional disorders. You either get dementia because there's something going on with the brain, or alternatively, emotionally, it doesn't affect the brain. Turns out that distinction, that Cartesian dualism, may not be correct.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with neuropsychologist Antonio Puente. He's also a professor of psychology at UNCW. When we come back from this break, we'll find out how Professor Puente's own experience as an immigrant may have shaped his views on immigration policy. We'll hear from some listeners. You can reach us via email on this Wednesday at coastline@whqr.org or give us a call at 910-343-1138. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Antonio Puente says brain science is complicated, but politics is more so. He's a professor of psychology at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, past president of the American Psychological Association, and he's the founder and co-director of a bilingual mental health clinic for people who are poor and underinsured, Cape Fear Clinic. You can ask your own question of Professor Puente on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also send an email to coastline@whqr.org. Just before we went to break, Professor Puente, maybe this is a bad term to use, but you dropped a bomb about studying kids in refugee camps and how you've learned that emotional trauma can cause these kids to exhibit symptoms that look like traumatic brain injury?
That's correct.
Where are these? Which refugee camps? Which countries?
This is in Palestine. One of my former postdoctoral fellows that came here from the University of Granada spent a year with us, has been studying the neuropsychological effects of children that are exposed to trauma, but also children that are not exposed to trauma who are living in these, if you will, refugee camps. And it turns out that we have been surprised at the findings that children who live inside the refugee camps appear to have a different kind of brain function than the kids who are living outside the refugee camps.
So knowing this, as a clinical neuropsychologist, what do you do? Is healing possible for not just the kids in the refugee camps, but the veterans who've come back from war zones, or the professional athletes?
Well, the question now before us is that of neuroplasticity. You know, historically we've thought, well, once the brain is injured, it's always injured. Glial cells populate that area, basically just make it impossible for things to regenerate, if you will, refunction. And we know that's not true. One of our professors at the university, Julian Keith, spent many years dealing with that. And we know that you can regrow the cells. The question is,
you can regrow brain cells.
You can regrow brain cells. The question is, can you regrow function? And we believe that that's possible. After all, that's what we do in psychotherapy. But it's a lot slower than just taking a pill. It requires long-term motivation, skill, and maybe just a tiny bit of luck to try and reframe the different kinds of circuits that the brain has taken many years to just get dewired.
It seems like you could put that whole idea on a spectrum and look at health as well for people. And you talked about the idea you're kind of turning on its head, the idea that emotions come from circumstances or environment. And you're saying it's starting to look like the brain and emotions cause behavior. So help me out here. I'm groping. But it seems like you could take this model and use it to help not just people who are suffering some form of pathology, but also people who are already healthy and make them healthier.
Well, you're bringing up two very important points. Let me begin with the idea of how does it all work? And I go back to my mentor, Roger Sperry, who discovered the two sides of the brain and the first psychologist to win a Nobel Prize. He believed that brain function gave rise to ideas, belief systems, if you will, and those belief systems in turn control the brain function. If I think I'm smart, I might study harder. If I think I'm too fat, I may not want to eat so much. So I think we have to understand that environment has an impact in all of this, but maybe the silent partner in determining behavior, cognition, and emotion has been the brain. And that's where we need to go dig deeper than we've ever had before, because that may be the last frontier. At the same time, we also can't forget that even though we have focused for many, many decades on brain illness, maybe we should begin to study brain health. What's the other side of the coin? Can we focus on prevention by getting good habits, good ideas, good belief systems in anticipation of the challenges that come before us each and every day of our job? Nobody's immune from stress. Nobody is immune, as our community experienced last fall, from natural disasters. How do we get ready for those? Brain health is the next frontier.
So how do we? And I just want to mention Marion has written in and she says, so excited about this episode and this important research. How can repair be promoted for those who have experienced this type of situation? And we've covered, I think, three major ones, the battlefield, the athletic arena, and kids in refugee camps. So are those three different areas of treatment?
Well, I think those are good illustrations of how we can do this. We've thrown away, as a society, people with brain injuries, people with mental health problems. We've stigmatized those. Well, if you got dementia, there's no reason to worry about it. If you have depression, well, we'll just do what we can, but good luck. That's just not the right attitude. That's not what the research suggests. There is opportunity. Now, whether we can engage in neuroplasticity in a way that we can get neurofunction to resume maybe better than it was, or at least at some levels that allow you to participate in society, that's where we need to go. I think there's hope. The literature is supportive of that. The clinic suggests that this is something that can be done, but it's not easy.
So you mentioned creating better belief systems. And that takes practice and commitment. Can you give us an example of that?
Well, today we have a groundswell support, what we call mindfulness, the whole idea of being present. Rather than worrying about who we've been or where we should go, maybe we should just focus on doing the very best we can at the present time. The attitude that that we have the capacity, that we have a hope, is something that we have just historically not attended to, and maybe that's where we need to be going.
Physical health has a big impact on brain health.
Well, maybe even the opposite. Maybe brain health has impact on physical health. We now know that, for example, cancer is more often seen in chronically depressed people. We know, for example...
I didn't know that we knew that.
Yes. So we now have to put ourselves in a situation that we have done a marvelous job as a society taking care of our physical health. But I think we've been not so good in taking care of our mental and brain health. And maybe in this particular capacity, while we treat the physical health, which is so critical, we should also treat the mental and brain health. Well, we have an epidemic of, for example, dementia in our society. As the baby boomers are aging, why don't we attend to getting ready for those years of our life where memory can be a bit of a challenge? But wisdom is plenty. Why don't we emphasize that instead of focusing on, well, you have a memory problem. You may have a memory problem, but you certainly don't have a lack of wisdom. Let's emphasize that.
And do you think that would make a difference for the people who feel the effects of dementia?
Oh, no question. Everybody has a place in our society, and we should not only be as good as our last top 40 hit.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with neuropsychologist and psychology professor Antonio Puente. He is a professor of psychology at UNCW and the founder of a bilingual mental health clinic in Wilmington for people who are poor and uninsured called Cape Fear Clinic. He's also past president of the American Psychological Association, and he's answering your questions on this Wednesday. You can either call us during the live discussion at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Antonio Puente, your personal history may inform some of your views on immigration policy. You are originally from Cuba. Tell us how you came to this country.
I came here on November 6, 1960, actually on my mom's birthday, 33rd birthday. We weren't expecting to stay. After all, revolutions in Latin America, not that unusual. I came with $300, a change of clothes, and no knowledge of the English language, assuming that I was going to be here for a few weeks, maybe a few months, and here I am a few decades later, being very much part of the rich fabric of this country.
Your parents were able to get asylum.
Yes. They asked and received asylum, which granted us a period of time during which we could seek citizenship.
And then... something happened and you were undocumented for a little while.
It turns out that, unbeknownst to me, that I had failed to apply for citizenship. I became a professor at St. George's University School of Medicine in Grenada, West Indies. And lo and behold, the communists came again. So I ended up having to leave literally at the last very possible moment, December 23rd, 1978, to be exact. And as we were flying over the Caribbean Sea in a small Cessna plane, I realized that I had not only an expired immigration card, but the color had even changed.
Literally.
The green card had actually become blue. Fortunate for me, I became... part of this country soon after that in an official fashion by becoming a citizen, one of the greatest opportunities of my life.
It was December of 2017. This would have been during the time that you were president of the American Psychological Association. You wrote an opinion piece for USA Today, and of course you led with the fact that you came to this country after your own parents fled Cuba. 8 years old when you arrived, you didn't know any English. What do you actually remember about those early years when you had to learn English and you were a stranger in this country?
Well, I remember not having food. I remember not knowing English and asking my mom, how was I going to adapt to this? And she said, you seem like a smart boy. You'll figure it out. Well, actually, it took me a while, but I did figure it out. Again, this is the country of opportunity, and I was given that opportunity. One of the things that's so challenging is it's not just learning the language. is understanding the culture, the unwritten rules. For example, in recess, we were playing football. It didn't make any sense that you would run after each other and jump and tackle the person and then laugh.
As you're giving this person a brain injury.
So,
but, is this why you became a neuropsychologist?
So it's all those nuances that are so difficult to understand. The idea that time is something in our culture that we enjoy. In this culture, you conquer. How fast can you do things? In our country, you start a party late, you end it who knows when. Here you start at 7, and everybody goes home at 10. How do you learn those rules?
Yeah.
There are no rules that says, read this book to become an American.
You didn't go through what some of the children who are being brought across the border by their parents have been going through over the last several years, and you have strong opinions about what the U.S. is doing and how they're handling these families who are coming through. Tell us about that.
Well, this has been a major concern for me individually and for the American Psychological Association as a society, because there's increasing evidence that separation of children from the parents, and for that matter, parents from the children, becomes not only an emotional problem, a psychological problem, but a public health hazard of unspeakable proportion. We're very concerned about the long-term impact, both on the children and the parents, as well as our country. This is not who we are as a country, and this is not what our goal is in terms of people in positions of need. I appreciate immigration laws. There's no question that that's imperative to the discussion. But as a scientist, as a psychologist, I'm very concerned about what's happening to these children. And in many ways, what's happening to the psyche of our country that we have, for better or worse, have not attended to this.
What do you mean we have not attended to it?
Well, I'll speak on behalf of the American Psychological Association. What are we doing to make sure that we're there to try and resolve this? We had a congressional hearing where we presented the evidence and basically saying, this cannot go on.
You presented evidence about the impacts on the children of separating the kids from their parents at the border.
That's correct. Okay. It was a congressional briefing, to be exact, in December of 2017, and we followed up with that. So we have to be present to address this issue. The society has to be present to address this issue. Now, the bigger question, which is political and outside my area of expertise, is how do we do this within the immigration laws that our country has developed over many, many, many years? It's a big challenge, but that's where we have to deal. So having lived this experience myself, having studied this experience, as my son, who is also a neuropsychologist, says, he says, Papa, it's not research, it's me-search. I've discovered this is an unanswered question that needs to be attended to.
Also, as part of your work with the American Psychological Association, you developed an advocacy component to that organization. Tell us about that and why you thought that was important.
During my tenure as president, we discovered that we were in a position that was being challenged by the changing social landscape that we were not prepared to address. The infrastructure of the association and the economic revenues necessary were simply not present. So after my year as president, we actually broke up the society into two parts, one for psychology and one for psychologists. The psychologist part is entirely on advocacy, ranging from guild issues such as reimbursement for psychological service to issues that we discuss, immigration, and the importance of funding psychological research. So we've now embarked on this mission of making sure that psychology is at the table, otherwise we'll become part of the menu.
I couldn't help when I was looking at the website of the American Psychological Association, the advocacy portion. There's a section that says APA strongly encourages the use of psychological science in policymaking decisions and vigorously defends the field from partisan attacks. And then it's broken down into sections on how APA speaks out for psychological science. But is it your view that science, specifically psychology, is under attack?
I think psychology is under attack, but maybe more importantly, science is under attack. We're going through a very tough period in our society where we value facts much less than we value opinions or partisanship. And we're the opinion, as a society has been there for 127 years, that first and foremost should be science. If we cannot have empirical foundation for a belief system, then it becomes a personal belief. And we're all entitled and encouraged to have those beliefs. But the foundation for policy at APA, something that we pushed very hard and continue to do so, is starts with science, ends with science.
How can you advocate then for science when you've already lost part of your audience to partisan views? And how did this even become a partisan issue?
Well, that is a question that I think requires more of a social discussion, and it's one that's perplexing me as well as many of my peers. But I think of this as some way, how do you deal with brain injury? You just go back to the well over and over and over again, using scientific means to make sure you're on the right track. Because otherwise, what's to say that my view is the correct view? We're in it for the long game. As Sperry would often tell me, the only way you can get real answers is twofold. You wait for it to happen, or you predict it by doing experiments to see what will happen.
You're talking about Roger Sperry, the first psychologist to win the Nobel Prize for his work on the right and left brains. We're going to talk about your archiving of his work when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline. It's a look at neuropsychology and what we're learning about the human brain. UNCW Professor Antonio Puente is with us today. You can ask your own question on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138 or emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. When we come back from this break, we'll have just one more segment for you to get your own question or comment in. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Antonio Puente, professor of psychology at UNCW, served as president in 2017 of the American Psychological Association. Years earlier, his parents brought him to the U.S. from Cuba, and later he was, for a time, an undocumented immigrant. His personal and professional understanding of what it's like for children to cross an international border has led him to speak to Congress and other news organizations about immigration policy, including both Time Magazine and WHQR. Professor Puente is answering your questions on this Wednesday. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. It is the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question or comment in. As we've discussed, one of your projects involved archiving the work of Roger Sperry, the first psychologist to win the Nobel Prize. He's known largely for his work, and he won the Nobel Prize for his work on the different functions of the right and left brains. And he was also your mentor. What did you learn from Roger Sperry that shaped you today?
Curiosity, impact, and the importance of social values. Despite the fact that his Nobel was awarded to him for his work on the two sides of the brain, and for that matter, his work on neurospecificity, how the brain regenerates itself after injury, the biggest concern for him was, how does the brain direct a value system that can make a world that's sustainable and productive? A big question, a big challenge for him, and I think that left a permanent mark in my own thinking.
One of the experiments that he did was on people who had their corpus callosum severed. And that is, actually, you should describe what that is, because I will get it wrong. What is the corpus callosum?
Well, the brain itself is made up of essentially two large masses, the the left and the right, the left hemisphere, right hemisphere. And it turns out that they were connected, they are connected by a large fiber structure, the biggest one in the brain, called the corpus callosum. And in cases of intractable epilepsy, as in the case of one of his most famous patients, LB, it was discovered that the two sides are sending firings across the corpus callosum in a way that were just unstoppable. That's what essentially epilepsy is. So it was hypothesized that if you cut the brain in half, you would reduce, mitigate, or basically get rid of the seizures themselves. It turns out that that was true. What was most surprising is that in the process of sustaining a control over the epileptic seizures, you end up discovering that the left brain was sequential, organizational, speech, math, logical, analytical, and the right was visual, spatial, emotional. Not surprisingly, it turns out that most computer scientists turn out to be right-handed. A large percentage of architects and artists are left-handed. But what Sperry hypothesized is this: the two sides of the brain coming together in a unified fashion that produces a unified person. In studying these individuals, including my own opportunity to test them, it was like you had two persons that were just disconnected. That's why we often refer to this as the disconnection syndrome. When you have...
So it's like two separate brains.
Two separate brains doing their own thing, and sometimes antagonistic. One sees things and the other one reads things. How do we get them all together? That's what the corpus callosum, and if you will, you have an epiphenomena rising to the top, producing a unified person.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with psychology professor Antonio Puente. He is at UNCW, is a clinical neuropsychologist, and he's answering your questions on this Wednesday. You can call us during the live Wednesday show at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Don from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hello, Dr. Puente. I'm interested in what you would think about or be able to gather from someone that is autistic and has had a lot of concussions and other medical treatments. Quite a bit of other medical treatments, too. That's myself. And I'm interested in how I found out about myself and what it seems to indicate about my interactions with my environment.
Well, Don, thank you for your question, and thank you for your courage as well. And let me address this in two ways. First of all, we have autism, and then second of all, we have the concussions. So each in their own right are challenges of great significance. However, when you put those two together, you have a hybrid that makes it even more complicated. So I can't imagine the challenge that you are experiencing under these circumstances. Now, how do you deal with this? Well, for autism, and in many ways also for brain injury, applied behavior analysis has been very, very fruitful. And that's you basically deconstruct the problem and you attack it little by little. But don't give up hope. This is certainly a time of reflection for you, but also a time of opportunity. So I wish you the very best.
I've always had hope, and I'd be interested in talking with you greater detail. Is that possible?
That is possible.
All right. You can find him at uncw.edu and just search the directory there. And we need to move on to our next caller. Don, thank you so much for that. We have Sean from Wrightsville Beach. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, Rachel. Hi, Dr. Puente.
Hi.
Hey, so what you all in the radio land might not know is Dr. Puente is a legendary surfer in this region. And my question to Dr. Puente today is, you're an amazing mind, a cerebral person. What is the process and how does surfing fall in your lifestyle? And I will take my comment off the air and thank you for a great show today.
Thanks, Sean. Great question.
Well, thanks, Sean. Great question, but I think your assessment of me as being a legendary surfer suggests you've been in the sun too long.
But surfing would promote mental health, would it not?
Well,
for so many reasons.
Well, for me, it's foundational. I came to UNCW for an opportunity. I stayed here for the lifestyle. The university grew. And for me, surfing is part of who I am and who my family is. We all surf. So it's very critical.
It's physical exercise, but there are other elements to it as well, right?
It's a spiritual exercise. It's a one place in my world where I disconnect and I find that centering. No question about it. And I particularly find that at the inlet between here and Figure Eight Island, where there are few people and great waves.
So there's a lot to unpack there that we won't do on this show. Our producer, Rachel Keith, has lobbied for a surfing show, and we will dedicate an entire hour to that, I promise. I want to go to a little bit of a darker place and first acknowledge Kathleen. Thank you so much. She says, thanks for sharing your mindful presentation and discussion. Much appreciated. We appreciate you, Kathleen. There was some policy discussion at the American Psychological Association about dealing with people who are prisoners in places that violate human rights. And I'm thinking of Guantanamo Bay, which is in Cuba, but it is maintained by the United States. And it was almost a year ago that the APA rejected a policy, this is according to the New York Times, after this escalating debate about the role of psychologists in military prisons. And APA ultimately rejected a policy that would have allowed members to treat detainees held at these sites that don't comply with international human rights laws. So what does that mean for those prisoners, and why did APA decide that way? Are you in agreement with that decision?
Well, it's important to appreciate the fact that even though I don't represent APA, my relationship with APA still remains very strong. So I won't speak on behalf of the association, but I'll speak on behalf of myself. I believe that mental health should be available to all. And the question is, how do we maintain that by making sure that we don't participate directly or indirectly in any form of interrogation or related practices that torture people? I'm of the opinion that everyone, regardless of political position or past activities in it may be less than acceptable behaviors, should be granted the opportunity for mental health intervention and, for that matter, mental health diagnostics as well. The question, however, it's also very complicated because we have to also deal with the individuals who practice in these places as well, for example, physicians and otherwise. Very complicated question, one that we need to attend to, and we're still working on it.
And there was an issue because some of these psychologists who were working in these prisons were actually starting to engage in really questionably, ethically questionable practices, such as telling interrogators how much a waterboarding victim would be able to take. Was that how this arose?
That's exactly how that arose. I might tell you the two psychologists that were part of this interrogation activities, and for that matter, a company that they started, were not part of APA. They were not members of APA, and they've been in many ways sanctioned by the American Psychological Association. We now know that it turns out that aggressive moves like waterboarding not only is inhumane, but it doesn't produce the desired effect, which is to obtain important information. There is no room for that kind of activity by psychologists.
So understanding that APA doesn't want to support any kind of activity that violates international human rights laws, do psychologists as healers have an obligation to people who are stuck in some of these places?
Well, there's no question, and that's a challenge that we're actually grappling as we speak. In other words, how do we support any individual that has mental health needs but do not participate in activities that violate human rights? That's a fine line that has yet to be drawn, and I look forward not only to being part of that conversation for APA to be able to address it in a way that is satisfactory.
Deborah writes, thank you, Dr. Puente and Dr. Keith. You mentioned Julian Keith earlier, one of your colleagues at UNCW, for all your hard work. Deborah says, I'm a therapist here in Wilmington. I'm trained in EMDR and wondering your thoughts on EMDR and trauma treatment. I've found EMDR very effective, she says. Also, I'm a registered art therapist. Thoughts on healing and creativity. What is EMDR?
Well, eye movement, desensitization exercises. I think this is the work of Francis Shapiro is pioneering and exciting. The research is still burgeoning. It's starting to grow. APA just went on record saying that there are certain treatments that are acceptable for post-traumatic stress disorder, and unfortunately, this is not one of them. But as time goes on, we look forward to additional scientific evidence to be able to support it. Now, just because there's not enough science to meet the rigors of what we consider acceptable doesn't necessarily mean that people shouldn't do it. Let's take the case of multiple sclerosis. You know, there's little evidence that acupuncture is useful for or massage, but that does not mean it should not be considered. And we have a long ways to go to make sure that science covers the entire waterfront. And one wonders, just because it's not scientific does not mean it does not provide effective results. So continue doing your work. I hope that your patients benefit from it, and I look forward to the research that should be forthcoming.
We also, Marion had written in earlier and asked about the role of spirituality in healing brain injury. Can you speak to that a little bit? You've alluded to that that's a component for you, which you engage with when you're surfing, for example.
Well, not only when I'm surfing, but actually I'm a practicing Catholic, but I'm very supportive of the idea of spirituality. Again, we don't have great evidence for it, but I'm not entirely sure just because we don't have it, we should consider it. Spirituality may be another frontier, just like brain health is. How do we study things that are sort of fuzzy, but so impactful? I don't know.
Is there an incentive to study those things? How do you get grants to study, say, whether massage works for multiple sclerosis?
Well, I think that we are going through a period where, if you will, fuzzy or in many ways pioneering research has not been attended to well in the scientific community or certainly in the funding community, but I hope that changes as time goes on. We can't just continue the same things that we've been doing historically. That's not how you shape the future of healthcare.
And we have just a minute or so left, but you told me that you are going to start a new lecture series. So this is content that you haven't disseminated before this way. Tell us one of the best takeaways from this new lecture series.
Well, I've been given an opportunity because of some unexpected awards to speak at an international level, and I think I'm going to bring forth an idea that at least is novel, maybe if not preposterous to some, and that is the concept that psychology is actually a branch of neuropsychology. Neuropsychology is the foundation of psychology and probably is our future as well. Stay tuned. See how our audiences receive that.
Why would that, coming from a layperson, be a novel idea if we define neuropsychology as everything, what the gap between what the brain does and then what comes out as human behavior?
Well,
we're back to the beginning.
That's it.
What is not neuropsychology?
And that's my question. That's the question I'm going to propose to the audiences. We started there, and I think that's where we're headed.
So what is the one thing that you would advocate everyone engage in to promote brain health?
Well, we've been talking about mindfulness today, but I think understanding that just taking care of your body is not enough. You got to take care of your mind, and you have to take care of your brain.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Professor Antonio Puente, thank you so much for being with us today.
Muchas gracias.
Coastline's producer is Rachel Keith. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caitlin Freund is our webmaster. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org, get the podcast, or find it on the HQR app. You can also tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 2. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.